for our audience of blind and print-impaired listeners. The North Carolina Reading Service presents the Indie Week. This issue is dated August the 31st, 2022, and it's read by John Federson for the North Carolina Reading Service. Glad to be back with you after a 2 or 3 week hiatus, being sent to cover events in global hotspots, including a seething cauldron of the shoreline resorts along Lake Michigan, which turn out to be more of an idyllic cool spot than a seething hot spot. So my hard-hitting feature on that has been shelved, and I've been told to just get on with reading the Indie Week. And so here it comes. And first up, from the op-ed, Michael Garrett, who is a Democratic state senator from Guilford County, writes, "A bankruptcy of ideas. The American people are fed up with modern-day politics, and rightly so. It's constant fighting, screaming, arguing, and too little focus on the issues families are facing at our kitchen tables. Today, if you read Republican politicians' op-eds and social media posts and watch their cable news appearances, you'll find a common theme: rooting for failure. It's time to ask, what is the Republican Party platform? Where are its policy proposals, and what are its solutions to address our shared challenges? An obsession with waging manufactured culture wars and little to no attention on the economic health and education challenges facing families reveals a bankruptcy of ideas within the modern-day GOP. As I write this, the Inflation Reduction Act has passed in the Senate and looks set to be enacted. This is a major win for all Americans, regardless of party, but the Senate vote tally doesn't reflect that. Both Democrats and Republicans agree on the need for deficit reduction. This bill does it. Both parties advocate a fairer tax code. This bill does it. Both parties say we need to lower prescription drug prices. This bill does it. However, there is virtually no Republican support in Congress for this bill, all while many Republican voters support the contents. The Safer Communities Act, which passed after the horrific mass shooting in Uvalde, was the first meaningful movement on gun laws in nearly 30 years. The act is packed with broadly popular, common-sense policies meant to keep kids safe. Parents, no matter their politics, want to know when they hug their children on their way to school it won't be the last time, but that didn't stop most Republicans in Congress from voting no on this school safety law. Infrastructure investment has been something both parties have pursued for decades. Today we have a meaningful down payment on badly needed repairs and new projects thanks to the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act that passed last year. Once again, most congressional Republicans opposed it. This is the clearest and simplest example of obstruction for obstruction's sake. There are many other examples of modern-day Republican politician bias towards rooting for failure, but I'm out of space. I don't raise this issue for political gain or to point a finger at particular elected officials. I raise it because I believe it is critical that we maintain a free marketplace of ideas with space for good faith disagreement. If one side chooses to simply root for failure instead of engaging in healthy debate, then that marketplace and our democracy fails. Going forward, let's ask our elected leaders and candidates for their ideas and solutions. Let's not simply accept what they are against. No more rooting for failure. Let's root for our success, even when we disagree. We'll transition now to IndieWeek.com, the online version of this, which has stories datelined a day later than the print edition, which I'm also going to read. This is from Jane Porter, who has datelined this morning. References to pro-life values mysteriously disappear from Beau Hines' website. Here's a funny thing. Bo Hines, the 27-year-old second coming of Madison Cawthorn, who doesn't like to be compared to Madison Cawthorn, has scrubbed his entire campaign website of any mention of pro-life values. But they featured heavily in his primary campaign for the Republican nomination for the 13th Congressional District. So that's weird, right? There used to be a whole page linked to Bo Hines' position on life and family on his website that has now mysteriously disappeared. Web archives indicate when you clicked the vanish link, a page would have popped up with the following statement. I am pro-life. I believe that life begins at conception and we must protect the rights of the unborn. I also believe in traditional marriage. We must fight to protect our core family values that are rooted in biblical principles. And they give a screenshot of the archived page. But you can't find any references to Bo Hines being pro-life or read anti-choice on his website anymore. Could it be that since the Supreme Court's Dobbs decision came down in June, North Carolinians, including those in Bo Hines' toss-up district, have vociferously and via survey indicated staunch support for abortion access and reproductive rights? Some polling certainly indicates that that's the case. IndyWeek.com provides a couple survey links. Let's not forget that before his primary, in which Hines ran against and defeated Devan Barber, Kelly Daughtry, Renee Elmers, Kent Kiersey, and three other candidates, he told the News and Observer that he would support legislation banning all abortions with no exceptions. Curiously, Bo Hines has been mum on the issue ever since. Here's another funny thing. There's a video on Bo Hines' website touting his endorsement from the legally embattled former president, one Donald Trump. But a public policy polling survey from last week indicates that of 506 residents polled, 56% in North Carolina's 13th district have an unfavorable opinion of the former president, while only 35% of respondents have a favorable opinion of Trump. How long before that video disappears from the website as well? The PPP survey shows Bo Hines running neck and neck with Democratic State Senator Wiley Nickel, both with 40% support from respondents and 20% undecided. So, go ahead, do the math, and place your bets now. DJT and a hardline anti-abortion stance likely won't play well in the new 13th district. We reached out to Bo Hines' campaign for clarification on his current position on the issues of reproductive rights and abortion access. We'll let you know if we hear back. The next article, also from IndyWeek.com, datelined today, the 1st of September, says early data shows Durham's community safety pilot programs are working. These programs, which rely on skilled, unarmed first responders to help resolve nonviolent calls to 911 call center in Durham, is set to expand soon, writes Lena Geller. Since launching in June, Durham Crisis Response have proven that unarmed first responders and mental health clinicians can successfully address nonviolent 911 calls without the help of law enforcement, and that with greater staffing, the programs could be helping a lot more people, according to new data from the Community Safety Department. The three programs, which operate under the name HEART, HEART, Holistic Empathetic Assistance Response Teams, have so far embedded a mental health expert in Durham's 911 call center, dispatched a three-person team of skilled, unarmed first responders to address behavioral health calls within a 15-mile region of the city, and provided in-person or phone-based follow-up care for callers 48 hours of their crises. As of August 30th, HEART has responded to 428 calls, with most relating to trespassing, urgent and non-urgent welfare checks, and intoxication. In-person response teams have not run into any safety issues, according to Community Safety Department Director Ryan Smith, who says, one of the biggest concerns that we heard during our year of planning was what it meant to send unarmed responders to calls we used to send police to with guns. I think we see here the same thing we've seen in other cities with these programs. There are calls that we can safely and appropriately send additional responders instead of law enforcement, and that we can free up those resources for law enforcement to focus on other areas. Of those 428 calls, 204 were addressed by in-person community response teams, 40 involved follow-up care, and 183 were handled over the phone by Lee Mazur, the mental health clinician embedded in the call center. If a caller requires in-person assistance, Mazur can dispatch a community response team, but she's found that many callers can work through their crises over the phone. Recently, she says, she spoke with a caller who was experiencing delusions and, quote, had a firm belief that certain events were happening in her home. Mazur says she was used to getting a lot of feedback about how things were not real, things are not happening, how this isn't true, what she's seeing and hearing. I was able to approach it from a lens of, this is real for you in this moment. Let's just focus on that and what it must be like to think these things are happening. By offering an appropriate verbal mental health response, Mazur was able to alleviate the caller's distress. She says it's important to be able to talk to somebody specifically in the moment of crisis. While Mazur has helped scores of callers over the past 2 months, she's only one person, and Durham is a big city. Since early June, the 9/11 Center has received 4,700 calls that have warranted a community safety response, according to this data released Monday. With their current staffing, the HEART programs have been able to address about one-tenth of them. But the team is set to expand soon. Next week, the programs will start offering their services 7 days a week instead of five. And by October, Smith says the program will hopefully have two additional response teams, one two-person follow-up team and another mental health clinician in that 9/11 center. The fourth and final pilot program, which will dispatch pairs of mental health clinicians and police officers in response to calls with greater safety risks, will launch in September. Smith says, we have a good foundation. We still have important things to learn, and it's only been 2 months. So I think it's important to give it time. Next, Jasmine Gallup writes about the North Carolina Association of Educators in Wake County. They released their school board endorsements for the midterm election, including candidates for school board. This NCAE, an advocacy organization for public school teachers and staff, released these endorsements last week, including picks for the Wake County School Board. The Wake County NCAE has historically endorsed liberal candidates who support increases in pay for teachers and staff, including bus drivers and cafeteria workers. The organization supports fully funding the Leandro Plan, an 8-year, $5.5 billion plan to improve education for children in low-wealth districts. Priorities of the NCAE also include tying teacher pay to experience rather than test scores, investing in school counselors and school construction, and increasing support for teachers in training. Unsurprisingly, the Wake County NCAE is supporting every incumbent running for re-election to the school board this year, as well as candidates outgoing incumbents have endorsed. These endorsements are in line with those of the Wake County Democratic Party. Here is the full list. And I'll just read the district and the names. Wake County School Board, District 1, Ben Clapsaddle. District 2, Monica Johnson Hustler, incumbent. 3, Doug Hammack. District 4, Tara Winters, incumbent. District 5, Lynn Edmonds. 6, Sam Hershey. District 7, Chris Hegarty, incumbent. District 8, Lindsay Mahaffey, incumbent. And Tyler Swanson in District 9. In the Wake County Board of Commissioners, District 1, Don Mial, M-I-A-L. District 2, Matt Calabria, who is incumbent. District 3, Cheryl Stallings and Vicki Adamson, an incumbent in District 7. The North Carolina House of Representatives, this endorsement, District 11, Allison Dahl, D-A-H-L-E, an incumbent. Ya Liu in District 21, Rosa Gill, incumbent from 33, Christine Kelly in District 33, and District 34, the Wake County NCAA is awaiting a vote on their pick from the statewide organizations. Going on to District 35 for the House of Representatives, Terrence Everett, incumbent, 36, Julie Von Heffen, incumbent, District 38, Abe Jones, incumbent, James Roberson, incumbent in 39, Joe John, incumbent in District 40, District 41, Maria Cervania, District 49, Cynthia Ball, incumbent, and District 66, Sarah Crawford. And finally, endorsements from the NCAE for the North Carolina Senate, District 13, Lisa Grafstein, 14, Dan Blue, an incumbent, District 15, Jay Chowdhury, an incumbent, District 16, Gail Adcock, and District 17, Sydney Batch. Those from the North Carolina Education Alliance, no, NCAE, North Carolina Association of Educators. Pardon me, that's from being absent for 2 weeks to read these things. All right, another positive report from Tomasi McDonald, datelined yesterday, but it's only on the internet page for Indie Week this week. North Carolina Central partners with Amazon for free education for workers. This week, NC Central officials announced the school has been selected as an education partner with Amazon's Career Choice program that enables its hourly workers to enroll at the university and access undergrad and grad degree programs in more than 140 fields and disciplines. After working with Amazon for 3 months, these retail giant employees can now attend Central University free of charge. Amazon officials have told NCCU leaders to expect around 25 students to enroll initially, according to a press release made public by the school. Tammy Thiemann, global program lead of Amazon's Career Choice program, noted in the release more than 80,000 Amazon employees around the world have already participated in Career Choice, quote, and we've seen firsthand how it can transform their lives. The release says that NCCU is the first historically black college and university in the state selected as an Amazon Career Choice school. Provost David Jackson Jr. said the Amazon partnership is a testament to the university's appeal and its commitment that it makes to all its student scholars to support, train, and empower their future career, saying, Amazon could have chosen any of the state's 11 HBCUs to launch this program, but we're glad they chose us. Clearly, Amazon officials recognize that North Carolina Central offers a flexible and unique array of academic programs coupled with local and global engagement opportunities, leadership development, and career readiness to students, particularly those with a non-traditional path. We look forward to continuing to grow our relationship with Amazon. The program, first launched in 2012, is an education benefit that empowers Amazon employees to learn new skills for career success with the company or elsewhere. The release says the program meets individual learners where they are on their education journey through a variety of education and upskilling opportunities, including prepaid college tuition, industry certification designed to lead to in-demand jobs, and foundational skills such as English language proficiency, high school diplomas, and GEDs. Here in the United States, the release notes that Amazon is investing $1.2 billion to upskill more than 300,000 employees by 2025 to help them move into higher-paying, in-demand jobs. In a word, NCCU officials are elated. Damon Wade, the Associate Vice Chancellor of Enrollment Management, says this is a tremendous opportunity for us. Anytime you can serve as a preferred education partner for a major corporation, you work diligently to make it happen. There are very few organizations we can partner with that have the impact that Amazon can. We're currently scheduling some virtual recruitment opportunities for their employees. Now, Kimberly Pfeiffer-McGee, the university's Associate Vice Chancellor for Extended Studies and Student Support, said a small core group of people across campus have been meeting to prepare for the first cohort of these choice students that are expected to enroll this fall. Adding, the school officials are predicting we're probably going to have a large number of Amazon employees taking our online courses. According to the school's press release, Career Choice Program has a, quote, rigorous selection process for partner educators and chooses partners focused on helping employees through their education programs while assisting them with job placements and overall offering education that leads to career success. Thiemann said, we're looking forward to North Carolina Central coming on board as a partner for Career Choice, adding to the hundreds of best-in-class offerings available to our employees. We're committed to empowering our employees by providing access to education and training they need to grow their careers, whether that's with us or elsewhere. Well, back to the print issue, and the cover story about Mr. Trevor Speer is called Paradigm Shift, and you'll understand that in about a moment. Lena Geller reports, I'm in a seedy parking lot on the fringes of downtown Raleigh, eating lettuce off the walls of a shipping container. The container, the kind you'd count on a freight train, houses half of Nanui's farm, a hydroponic homestead where owner Trevor Speer has spent the past 3 years growing leafy greens, herbs, root vegetables, and edible flowers out of irrigated floor-to-ceiling panels. Pristine and climate-controlled, the farm's two modular units operate year-round, using just 5 gallons of water per day and producing around 1,000 heads of lettuce each week. While the farm's environmental benefits run aplenty, water and land conservation, no pesticide runoff, a hyper-local distribution model that, in a cool inversion of the container's original usage, eschews the carbon footprint of long-distance shipping. Speer, a sort of health-conscious Willy Wonka, is most enthused by Nanui's ability to provide local chefs with unique, often off-season produce. Ashley Christensen, for one, once asked Speer to grow 6 different types of mustard greens for a salad special at her Raleigh restaurant, Pool's Diner. Speer regularly sells produce to local restaurants, including Hummingbird, Carol's Kitchen, St. Rufine Oysters, Crawford & Son, and Jolie. And he calls it a paradigm shift. We're completely changing the way they cook because we can grow anything at any time, and then they can create anything. Walking down the aisle of the container he calls Juanita, Speer tears off leaves and buds for me to try. There are some familiar ones like romaine and basil, but many I've never heard of, such as a yellow flower called a buzz button that offers an electrifying Pop Rocks-esque zing before causing my entire mouth to go numb. For centuries, people ate buzz buttons to numb toothaches. Speer says now bartenders use them to garnish cocktails. While Speer is relatively new to modular farming, his interest in agriculture is rooted in his childhood and his farm's namesake. When he was a kid, he liked to spend time in his grandma's garden, where the rows of vegetables seemed to stretch on forever. Sometimes his grandma, Nanui, as she was dubbed by Speer's cousin Skeet, who couldn't pronounce the word nanny, gave him small tasks, including plucking pesky leaves from tomato plants and replenishing the bait in her homemade slug traps. Speer says that we poured beer into pie pans and all the slugs would come and drown themselves, or Nanui would cut them in half with the end of her hoe. Speer grew up in New Bern on the banks of the Neuse River. His grandmother lives 40 miles north in Beaufort County, and Speer says he savored the holidays and summer breaks that he spent with her. Quote, "That's where I got my love for growing things, hanging out with my grandmother at a young age." For the first 35 years of his adult life, Speer channeled that love into building houses. But 4 years ago, itching for a change of pace, he decided to hang up his hard hat and follow a lead he'd come across while reading a profile of Kimball Musk. Musk, a restaurateur, agrotech magnate, and brother to the richest man in the world, had just launched Square Roots, an urban farming company that houses hydroponic farms in shipping containers. Speer, drawn by the startup's fusion of architecture and agriculture, set off to tour that facility in Brooklyn. He was immediately sold on the concept. With his own modular farm, he realized he could carry on Nanui's horticultural legacy without having to navigate the climatic uncertainties of traditional farming, which had always repelled him from the field. After doing some research, Speer learned that Freight Farms, the company that pioneered that container farm model, was selling its units to novices. He purchased two containers and underwent the company's intensive training process, and by December 2019, he was, as Nani would put it, growing lettuce upright in the air condition. Speer is one of more than 500 farmers in Freight Farms International Network. The company was founded in 2013 by Brad McNamara and John Friedman, two friends who spent years devising a way to make urban agriculture an economically viable way to produce food. With an accessible urban farming model, they believed they could promote sustainable agriculture as well as combat food insecurity in food deserts and remote areas of the world. Caroline Katsarubas, director of events and partnerships at Freight Farm, said, "They were really looking for something that was a turnkey solution so that anyone could get started farming." Friedman and McNamara initially planned to build rooftop greenhouses, Katsarubas says, but dismissed that concept after realizing it was too cost prohibitive. Eventually, they landed on the idea of constructing farms inside shipping containers, which were cheap, widely available, and when outfitted with climate control technology, capable of sustaining agriculture in places where it would otherwise be impossible. While the units are more affordable than other types of urban farming, these startup costs still run high. Freight Farm's current container model, the Greenery S, is priced at about $150,000. The unit also requires about 190 kilowatt hours of energy per day, which can be costly for both operators and the environment. For context, that 190 kilowatt hours, the average American household uses about 29 kilowatt hours of energy each day. Katsarubas, who calls the electrical draw the pain point of this industry, says Freight Farms is working to integrate clean energy systems into its containers and notes that the current model can run on solar power. The company also offers an extensive financing guide of loans, grants, and incentives for prospective buyers. If numbers are any indication, the company's farms have proven to be fairly accessible thus far. They currently exist in 34 countries and nearly every state in the United States, and the company's network of farmers is the largest in the world. Some units are operated by seasoned farmers who grew tired of climate fluctuation and varying yield and switched to the container model to future-proof their operations. But most are operated by people like Speer. Katsarubas says the majority don't have traditional farming experience. However, they typically have a tie to farming or gardening somewhere in their family history, which is really cool because the technology allows them to carry that on in this new way. At Nanoe's, Speer's 19-year-old son, Brayton, is poised to keep the tradition going. Brayton never enjoyed school. He wasn't a bad student, he says, but a rebellious man who lived in-school suspension. And since graduating high school and working full-time at Nanowies, he's found a vocation in working with his hands, he says. It becomes sort of Zen, like yoga, where your mind wanders because you have this muscle memory of just putting the seed in a plug over and over again. It's very relaxing, very peaceful. You sort of travel to the back of your mind and figure out all your issues. He says it's the best job he could ask for. When I set out to visit Nanowies, I assumed that Spear and his son would be driven by the same macro motives that Freight Farm lists on its website: revolutionizing the farming industry, providing fresh produce for underserved communities, saving the planet. In many ways, Nanowies is contributing to these initiatives. The agriculture industry is facing an aging crisis. The average American farmer in their late 50s, and only a tiny fraction of the younger generation is drawn to the field. In bringing his son on board, Spear is working to reverse this trend. During the first year Nanowies was operating, the pandemic forced most restaurants to close. So Spear donated 80% of his produce to food banks. And because the container farms are, by and large, inherently eco-friendly, Nanowies is helping to reduce the environmental burden of food production, whether or not it's Spear's main mission. While the priorities that Spear shared are more personal, honoring his heritage, watching things grow, making his mark on the local restaurant scene, sustainability is still sustainability, even if it's a side effect. Freight Farms, then, is technology at its best. Get into it for your own reasons, and make the world better in the process. Next, from Tomasi McDonald, death penalty on trial. North Carolina's death penalty goes on trial this week in Raleigh. Prior to 2016, when he was charged with the shooting death of a 28-year-old man in a Northwest Raleigh motel room, Brandon Xavier Hill had a relatively insignificant criminal record. He was convicted of careless and reckless driving in Durham in 2013. In 2014, charges of going armed to the terror of the public and assault with a deadly weapon were dismissed because of lack of evidence. Charges in March 2016 of assault on a woman and larceny of a firearm were also dismissed, court records show. In custody at the Wake County Jail for the past 6 years, Hill is now fighting to avoid being sentenced to death by a jury that's, quote, whiter, more male, and with less religious diversity than the community, according to a motion filed last month by a team of lawyers who are members of the American Civil Liberties Union's Capital Punishment Project in downtown Durham. Hill's trial begins this month. The ACLU capital defense attorneys are hoping the motion filed in the Wake County Superior Court will bolster Hill's chances of staying alive if he's convicted by halting a pernicious jury selection process known as death disqualification. According to Laura Swinford, a spokeswoman with the North Carolina chapter of the ACLU, Brian Stoll, one of the ACLU attorneys representing Hill, told the Indy this week, the two-day hearing will begin on Wednesday and the motion will be considered by Wake County Senior Resident Superior Court Judge Paul Ridgway, who will also preside over the capital trial. Stoll added that if Ridgway denies the motion, Hill's defense team will consider appealing to the state's Supreme Court. On Wednesday, ACLU attorney Henderson Hill is going to examine UNC Chapel Hill historian Seth Koch, who will lay out the racist history of the state's use of the death penalty and how it intertwines with lynching. Kristen Collins, a spokeswoman with the Center for Death Penalty Litigation, told Indy. Collins says that on Thursday, Henderson Hill will present the testimony of Kami Chavis, a nationally known criminal justice expert and law school professor at the College of William and Mary. Collins says Chavis, quote, will testify to all the current day racial inequities that make support for the death penalty lower in the black community. Explaining, so, while on September 12th, Brandon Hill will be on trial, on Wednesday and Thursday, we will be putting the death penalty on trial. Swinford states in a press release, the ACLU's motion argues that because death disqualification impermissibly excludes jurors based on race, gender, and religion, it'll violate Mr. Hill's rights under the U.S. and North Carolina Constitution. Swinford says the state's prosecutors have used death disqualification to certify community members who are more likely to impose the death penalty to serve on capital juries. Stating in the release, this means jurors who object to the death penalty are not able to serve on capital juries. Wake County District Attorney Lauren Freeman declined to comment about the Hill case currently pending in court, but speaking generally, she says there are many legally sound reasons that an attorney may strike a juror. She told Indy this week, it is false to suggest that there is any systemic effort to exclude jurors based on race, gender, or any other category. According to the motion, the ACLU attorneys contend, quote, the removal of community members from capital juries under the rubric of death qualification is an antiquated, discriminatory, unfair, and unconstitutional practice that Brandon Hill moves to bar at his capital trial. The ACLU attorneys argue in the court affidavit that the practice removes jurors who come to this courthouse willing and able to participate in our democracy in the most serious cases. As a consequence of the practice, quote, black Americans, women, and people of faith, specifically Catholics, are disproportionately excluded from serving on capital juries, the attorneys state in the 295-page motion. Not unlike the gerrymandered electoral process that has resulted in a Republican-dominated General Assembly in Raleigh, so-called death-qualified juries reflect, quote, a gerrymandered slice of the community, not a cross-section, according to the motion. Predictably, death-qualified juries, quote, are more likely to convict and more likely to impose death, even though the practice skews both the demographics and the attitudes of juries in capital trials. The result, the attorneys argue, are perverse outcomes as a consequence of seating capital juries that are, quote, the least diverse and least impartial. The motion points to a new 46-page study by Michigan State University College of Law that examines a decade of capital jury selection in Wake County cases that, quote, demonstrates the toll of death disqualification. The study shows, the attorneys state in the motion, quote, that death disqualification county in Wake County's last 10 capital trials excluded black potential jurors at twice the rate of white jurors and black women at significantly higher rates. However, only one of those 10 cases resulted in the jury recommending the death penalty for Ciega Edwards Gillard, Brandon Hill's accomplice, who in 2019 was sentenced to death row. When Indy pointed out that only one of the 10 cases reviewed by Michigan State study resulted in a death sentence, Stull credited those outcomes to the vigorous defense of the accused, despite the unfairness of the death disqualification, and to Freeman seeking death at an aggressive rate that is out of step with her community. Stull added that death disqualification process, geared supposedly at giving the state a fair shot at the death sentence, is a tail wags the dog of the determination of guilt versus innocence. Our client, Hill, is presumed innocent, explains Stull. Death disqualification will result in a less diverse jury, and we know that less diverse juries deliberate less thoroughly, question the evidence less vigorously, while crediting police officers more readily and convicting more frequently if the state is allowed to gerrymander Mr. Hill's jury and exclude significant voices in his community, then his right to a fair and impartial jury on the question of his guilt will be compromised. The study also revealed that Wake County prosecutors further rid the jury of black Americans and women with a second tool, peremptory strikes, removing black prospective jurors more than twice as often as white, and black women at the highest rate of all. The ACLU attorneys state in the motion, in total, with these two procedures, prosecutors rid the jury of over 40% of black potential jurors, while also disproportionately excluding people of faith and Catholics. Moreover, women oppose the death penalty at greater rates than men and, as a consequence, are unrepresented on capital juries, while people of faith, especially Catholics, even though they are well represented throughout the state and Wake County, are not well represented on North Carolina juries, according to the motion. The study's findings about race are troubling. According to the motion, quote, removing black jurors skews juries in favor of conviction, while death qualification skews juries in favor of conviction and execution. The Michigan State Study Review of Capital Trials in Wake County between 2008 and 2019 found that among the 485 jurors excused for hardship, the most frequent reason for exclusion was for death disqualification and additional reasons. The second most frequent exclusion was for death disqualification alone, according to the motion. On a late Friday morning in 2016, while working as a staff writer with the News and Observer, I arrived at a Northwest Raleigh motel where hours before police had found a young pregnant mother and the father of her children shot dead in a room. Police found the slain couple, April Holland and Dwayne Garvey, in a second floor room at the America's Best Value Inn near Crabtree Valley Mall before dawn on December 2nd. The next day, police charged Gillard, 28, and Hill, then 29, with first-degree murder. Investigators accused Hill of shooting Garvey. Police say Gillard shot Holland, who was 4 months pregnant. Gillard is on the state's death row, where he was charged with high-risk act in July and with assault with a weapon in 2020, according to the State Department of Public Safety website. Gillard, whose name also appears as Gaillard on federal documents, had terrorized women before. 1 week before the fatal shootings, he appeared in court on charges of robbery with a dangerous weapon, first-degree kidnapping, first-degree forcible sexual offense, and assault by strangulation, after police accused him of raping a woman while brandishing a handgun 2 months earlier and stealing her cell phone, wallet, and an ID card. The woman told police that Gillard wrapped a phone cord around her neck. Federal records show he was convicted in the Virgin Islands in 2007 of third-degree domestic violence assault. Gillard was also charged with attempted murder in 2011 following the shooting of two men at a Durham apartment complex, but prosecutors dropped the charges because of insufficient evidence, state records show. Gillard and Holland were old acquaintances. Garvey's older brother, Dwight Garvey, and his sister-in-law, Ravion Garvey of Raleigh, told me in 2016, her past came back to haunt her, Dwight said. The Garveys would not discuss the nature of Holland and Gillard's past relationship. Ravion said, what we can say is Dwayne died defending the love of his life. Holland and Dwayne Garvey first met in late 2011 when they were both living at the Pines of Ashton Apartments near Wake Med Hospital. Dwight said his brother and Holland became friends, but that friendship turned into love. The couple's family did not readily accept the interracial romance between a white woman and a black man. Ravion said he was defying everybody for her, and she was defying everyone for him. Dwayne Garvey and Holland were awaiting the birth of their fourth child. At the time of their deaths, they were the parents of three toddlers, two boys aged 2 and 1, and a 3-year-old daughter. Meanwhile, Hill, quote, does not ask for the inclusion of any specific jurors, the attorneys state in that motion. He seeks only to avoid the discriminatory culling of the jury to exclude large segments of the population. And another submission from Jasmine Gallup is next from Raleigh, Growing Pains. Another day, another controversial rezoning in Raleigh, this time in North Hills. Do you want a 30-story tower built across the street from your neighborhood? That's the question at the heart of a long, messy debate over Kane Realty's proposal to put 12, 30, and 40-story towers on the outskirts of North Hills. The well-known real estate development embarked on an effort to renovate North Hills about 2 years ago when the old JCPenney shut down. Kane Realty announced plans to build two new office towers, an apartment building, and a public plaza on the site of the defunct department store, all anchored by businesses on the ground floor. Next up was the North Hills Innovation District, a roughly 33-acre site between St. Albans Drive and I-440 that would be home to three new apartment complexes, two office towers, and a food hall, again, anchored by businesses at a street level. Now, with construction underway at both sites, Kane Realty is proposing another series of new developments along Six Forks Road and I-440. About 4 months ago, the company asked Raleigh City Council to approve a rezoning request for 30 and 40-story towers on land that was originally zoned for 12-story buildings, a proposal that was met with immediate backlash. Larry Helfand, chairman of the Midtown Citizens Advisory Council, which the city no longer officially recognizes since it formally abolished CACs in 2020, is one of the people leading the charge against Kane Realty's rezoning proposal. If that proposal is approved, a 30-story tower could go up at the intersection of Six Forks Road and I-440, across the street from a traditional neighborhood currently composed of single-family homes. 12-story buildings would also be allowed on land originally zoned for 5 stories. Helfand says the number one issue is building heights, and I just don't understand it. Kane has been reasonable in all his developments in the past, and this one has no logic to it at all. There is some order to Kane's plan. Although Kane Realty's proposal is well beyond what existing zoning allows, the taller towers are planned for the heart of North Hills, in areas that abut Six Forks Road and I-440. On the land closer to neighborhoods, Kane Realty has proposed a shorter, 12-story towers. Helfand, however, says he doesn't want office or apartment towers overshadowing the neighborhoods or the existing buildings in North Hills. He also opposes Kane's cutting down trees around a Big Branch River, where other Kane Realty properties are planned. The heavily wooded area across from another neighborhood will be deforested significantly to make room for new construction. Helfand is also worried about tall apartment buildings bringing an influx of traffic to Six Forks Road, which he says is already aging, overcrowded, and unsafe. He and his neighbors want to be able to walk their dogs, stroll to a local park, or send their kids out on bikes, he says. They're in favor of building connecting greenways and preserving natural areas. Another concerned resident, Shane Collins, says to get down to North Hills is a traffic nightmare. We live in the area and we just don't go there because it's a mess. There's too much traffic, and we're going to have more traffic with more towers and more density. These concerns, building heights, traffic, and the environment are common criticisms raised at most hearings on new development. It's easy to lump them together as part of a broad anti-development stance. There's a lot of emotional rhetoric, people imploring the city council not to destroy neighborhoods or talking about how the developers will come for you next. But these protesters have some legitimate concerns. Many across the city are frustrated by tall towers developers are building to necessarily increase density but also to increase profit. They're discouraged by the heavier traffic and the higher cost of living these new buildings will bring. Residents across Raleigh share Helfand's opposition to the new development. City Councilman Patrick Bufkin, who represents much of North Raleigh in District A, says the concerns are pretty widespread and even broader than the immediate neighborhoods. Folks in Quail Hollow in North Hills Lakemont, they have felt the brunt of being in a place that's changed probably more than any other part of the city. And what that means is cut through traffic. Over the past several months, the City Council has worked with Kane Realty to add a number of conditions to the new development, many of them transit-related. Kane agreed to reserve land along Six Forks Road for a new city bus station with a seating area and covered bus shelters, since the proposed rezoning overlaps with an existing bus station. They also agreed to the construction of new bicycle lanes and four new bike share stations. Another condition was that the company reserve land along Rowan Street for a future expansion of the Raleigh Fire Station, since the existing station does not have the equipment or employees needed to adequately protect such tall buildings. The reservation of the land, valued by Kane Realty but as between $20 and $22 million, will have significant public benefit, argues the company. But Helfand says the rezoning conditions were added out of necessity, not in a good-willed effort to improve the city. 2 weeks ago, the City Council heard Kane's rezoning proposal yet again, but ultimately sent it back to the Transportation and Transit Committee to refine some of the existing conditions, namely to address continuing concerns about greenways and bike lanes, building heights, and affordable housing. Residents' opposition to the new North Hills development hinges on a few things, primarily the development's violation of the Midtown St. Albans area plan, which the City Council adopted just back in 2020. The plan, created in response to increasing development in Midtown, addresses the area's need for more connecting roads. It also recommends building rise no higher than 20 stories and says plans for 20-story buildings should include improvements to public space and contingencies to mitigate environmental impact. The plan is one of dozens of small area plans across the city, which are mostly driven by long-term Raleigh residents. Many of these plans limit new development and call for the preservation of green space. Some residents argue that plans contain critical recommendations that should be followed no matter what. Others see them as blunt force tools to stop any and all new development. As a City Council member, Bufkin says he gives different small area plans different weight. The more recently a plan has been adopted and the more detailed it is, the more weight it should receive, he says. He adds, once you get past 5 or 7 years, it's probably time to revisit a question whether the plan remains appropriate. A small area plan is not an absolute requirement. We have a state statute that says it's policy guidance. It should be considered, but it's not a hard and fast regulation or prohibition. The Midtown St. Albans area plan is one of 25 city policy staff considered when making their recommendation to council. These policies outline the kinds of things the City Council wants when it comes to new development, such as higher density, more housing, opportunities to bike or walk, renovation of underdeveloped property, and access to public transit. Whether or not Kane's proposal offers these things is a matter of opinion. City staff concluded the company's proposal complies with 22 of the 25 policies, including recommendations that the new development be compatible in height and density with the surrounding area. In an effort to get the rezoning approved, the company has offered to institute a 12-foot step back for buildings taller than 13 stories at the intersection of Lassiter Mill Road and I-440. One major policy the initial proposal violated outright, however, was the recommendation that residential towers include affordable housing. The policy states that 10% of apartments in such towers should be affordable to people who make 80% of the area median income, the AMI. In Raleigh, a person making that amount makes about $60,000, according to the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development. That's a pretty high bar for affordable housing. Most teachers, electricians, chefs, and police officers make much less than $60,000 a year. Still, at that salary, an affordable apartment would cost no more than $1,500 per month. In an effort to assuage the council's affordable housing concerns, Kane offered last week to make 10% of any apartments built along Six Forks Road, quote, affordable housing. In this case, that means 600 square foot micro units that cost roughly $1,300 per month. Hardly an appealing prospect for a mid-sized housing market like Raleigh. With that kind of rezoning condition, it's hard to see how Kane's planned apartment buildings would actually lead to more reasonably priced housing, even when an apartment costs less than market price. It's still out of reach of many middle and lower class workers. And 600 square feet doesn't even approach the realm of feasibility for a working class family of three or four. Regardless, most, if not all, apartments in North Hills seem to be marketed as luxury units for the wealthy. Apartments in the 36-story Kane Realty Complex, called the Eastern, cost well beyond what most Raleigh residents make in a month. A 600-square-foot studio starts at $2,400 per month, according to the website, and a three-bedroom penthouse costs upward of $14,000 per month. The building comes equipped with rooftop lounge, resort pool, private dining room, expansive gym, and a spa for residents and their pets. Ultimately, many on the City Council are supporting Kane Realty's proposal as a part of a larger pro-development strategy. Even with the outrageous rents, Kane Realty has built or is building more than 1,000 apartments in North Hills, a significant boost to the housing supply that could ultimately ease prices in the greater market. The company is also asking to build up rather than out, which is more efficient and environmentally friendly. And by the clock is ticking over on my computer screen, it tells me I must cut this article short. There's a bit more, a few paragraphs left, which I won't have a chance to read. But Indie Week on paper or IndieWeek.com will have the remainder of this, plus many other arts and culture-related stories that I have been unable to do this week. They include articles about the American Dance Festival's fall weekend season at the North Carolina Museum of Art and Acme workers celebrating a National Labor Relations Board win, labor relations, and the Nasher Gallery of Art revealing the real Roy Lichtenstein, and one or two others. And our thrilling theme music comes back again, allowing John Feddersen, your reader today for the North Carolina Reading Service, the chance to say farewell to you all, and we'll be back in a week with the next issue of Indie Week. Thanks for listening.